Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As I speak, there are 7 active fires in California, burning more than 140,000 acres. According to the LA Times, that's more than twice as many acres burned in the first 6 months of this year when compared to the same period last year, and hundreds more fires. And last year was a record. Long before European settlers came to California, fires ran uninhibited throughout the Golden State. For indigenous communities, fire is a part of their traditions. It brings about life. It allows them to manage their land and encourages healthy vegetation growth. The tradition of cultural burning became outlawed in the 1800s when colonizers began to settle in California. In 1935, there was a huge push from the U.S. Forest Service to put out all wildfires with a 10 a.m. policy, to put out all forest fires by 10 a.m. the next day. But as vegetation grew, so did the fuel for fires. Now, cultural burning is being used as a tool for forest management. With the help of indigenous communities, fire is being lit again to mitigate wildfire. Joining us now to explain cultural burning is Elizabeth Azuz. She is with the Cultural Fire Management Council and a member of the Yurok tribe from the village of Wechpec. Elizabeth, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Elizabeth, starting off, many people over the last century have learned to fear fire and put it out as soon as flames are ignited. Why should people learn to embrace fire?
We need to learn to embrace fire because otherwise we're going to be in a catastrophic state for years. We make the joke that we like to blame Smokey the Bear for, you know, telling everybody to put fires out. And, you know, it's really important for people to understand that fire is part of the landscape. It's one of the crucial elements. And for us, you know, being able to restore our land, restore the food sources, the medicines, the things that the earth provides us is, you know, life-giving. It's something that we teach our children. It's something that we learn from our elders. So, you know, people really need to understand and need to realize that fire is a tool. It's one of the sharpest tools we have in our toolbox for restoring the environment.
You know, what I found so interesting as we're amid, you know, another wildfire season that's rivaling record in historic years past, that before 1800, when indigenous burning was essentially prohibited in the United States, several million acres burned every year in California due to both indigenous burning and lightning-caused fires, which is actually far more than even the worst wildfire years today. Who taught you how to use fire as a way to care for the land?
When I was a very young child, like most children, you're curious, my grandfather caught me playing with matches. He was blind, so it wasn't hard for him to smell what I was doing. But he sat me down and he explained to me the importance of human beings on the land, how important it was to restore our environment, to care for the animals, to care for the people. He told me how important it was to heat our homes, to cook our food, you know, to provide for the community in a way that a lot of people are amazed at all of the resources that we gather off of the land. Today, still, you know, we are a subsistence gathering people. It's, you know, it's something that is ingrained in me, to be honest. You know, I remember the stories. I remember each elder giving me their interpretation of how important it was for us to be able to maintain our environment.
Maintaining that tradition is difficult in California. You know, burn permits are usually required, and some counties offer special permits for tribes to facilitate burns. But that is challenging. There are obstacles to that. And given that indigenous burning was outlawed for at least a century, how is this part of your culture, an important part of your culture, passed down?
The permitting process is a bit cumbersome. We managed to have great working relationships with the fire entities, Cal Fire, the Forest Service, Humboldt County Air Quality in our area. Building those relationships is what helps you to sustain an environment in a safe and healthy way. we've been able to work with them. They come out, they've witnessed our practices, they've seen how we train our participants. They've even participated with us on some burns, which has been really great because growing up as a child, I remember being told if you see a red truck or a green truck, you have to run. You know, the elders believe that they wouldn't shoot a child or arrest a child. And so that's why the younger generation was taught to, you know, bring back our practices, because the elders believe that the powers that be, law enforcement or, you know, fire agencies would not harm a child. You know, in the time of my grandparents and great-grandparents, you could be shot or hung for, you know, burning. It was considered arson, obviously. For us, we were just doing what we knew to take care of our environment. But for other people, you know, the fear was so great that they needed to make us stop right away.
So I guess with that, how did we get to this point where the Yurok tribe and multiple other tribes are partnering with the Forest Service to manage the land?
You know, the Yurok tribe in specific, we have some of the greatest basket weavers, I believe, in the world. And our women were running out of materials. You know, some of our basket materials are serotonous plants, which require fire to be usable. And we basically had to have those hard conversations. And so we had a meeting with Building Healthy Communities, actually. And the young man came to our community. He gathered as many people as he could together. And he asked us, what type of an action would we like? And a community that has a very tiny church, a very small convenience store, and a two-room school asked to bring fire back to the ground. They didn't ask for, you know, transportation. They didn't ask for a hospital. They didn't ask for any of the things that are more than an hour and a half from us. They asked to restore their environment. They asked to restore their basket materials, their medicines, and their foods. And after quite a few meetings, you know, the young man said to us, well, we'll never be able to accomplish this. We'll have to have at least 500 people in this room. We'll have to have media. We'll have to have all of these action plans and meetings to make this happen. And Yurok women tend to be quite strong-willed. And we decided that we were going to make this happen and it was going to be a success. 8 years later, we are a functioning nonprofit. We've evolved out of a community local organizing group into a thriving nonprofit that now employs a full-time staff, a part-time staff, has purchased multiple vehicles and equipment for our crews. You know, we don't take no for an answer, basically. We just keep fighting the fight until we get to the point where we're standing where we want to be.
What role are cultural fires playing in wildfire mitigation across the state?
A lot of them are helping to protect, you know, homes, structure protection. What we do out here with our crew is we have elder structure protection where we clear around elders' homes. We have fire protection for the schools, for our Head Starts, our elementary schools. We also provide community training where we teach family-based burning, where we work with the Indigenous Peoples Burning Network through the Nature Conservancy. We teach families how to prepare their homes, clear around their homes, and how to burn safely. We provide equipment and assistance for them, but we teach them how to do that themselves so that we can bring this back in a safe way.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Elizabeth Azuz about Indigenous burning and how it helps in caring for the land. You know, Elizabeth, you help teach wildland professionals how to use fire to clear the land of fuel, and that helps the underbrush, it encourages new plant growth. What are some of the hesitations you've seen from professionals when teaching them to use fire as a tool to prevent wildfires?
Yeah, it's been really interesting for me because, you know, we're working with fire suppression, you know, people. We call ourselves fire lighters. We're not firefighters. We don't fight against family. We work with family and we consider fire family. So by the time our trainings are done, these people, participants from all over the world, literally, understand that what we're doing is restoring a balance. We're restoring our ecosystem, and that we're trying to do it in a healthy way, you know, minimizing the type of fuels that are used to complete a burn. You know, when we walk into a unit, we do field trips in these units. We take them in, we show them the cultural plants, the basket plants, the medicines, the foods, and we explain to them what we would like done in those areas, you know, as far as protecting those species. We do burns, you know, for elk reintroduction. Their prairies and meadows are disappearing because of all the fire seclusion, so they don't have places to live.
Elizabeth Azuz is with the Cultural Fire Management Council and a member of the Yurok tribe from the village of Wetchpec. Thank you for spending time with us. Up next, we take a look at the ruling against DACA and what it means for those who are protected by the law. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Since 2012, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, protected certain undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children from deportation. The law deferred deportations for 2 years at a time before reapplying for protection. According to the New York Times, more than 800,000 immigrants known as Dreamers have been protected. Last week, U.S. District Judge Andrew Hannon of Houston struck down the law, putting a stop to approving new applications. This set an end to the only protections for those who were brought into the United States illegally as children, leaves many wondering what happens now. Joining us to help us understand the legal implications of the federal ruling is Professor Maria Pabon with Loyola University New Orleans College of Law. We also have Raices attorney Daniel Hatoum. Raices is a nonprofit that provides free and low-cost legal services to underserved immigrant children, families, and refugees. Welcome both of you to Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Maria, starting with you, what will it take for the federal government to appeal this decision?
Well, President Biden has said that he will appeal it. So it's already going to take an appeal right there in that district court in Texas. But also there's ways around one by making the policy become a rule. During the litigation, Judge Hannon asked, is the government planning to create a rule instead of just a policy? That's how DACA began. And the government said yes, so they're working on a rule. And then the other one is there's already a House bill that was passed in March, H.R. 6, which would be a law that would make DACA an actual law. Right now it's just a policy enacted by the Obama administration that's caused all this litigation.
How confident are you that Congress will act, you know, given the political climate? Because if Congress doesn't act, there's a likelihood this could head to the Supreme Court.
Yes, there's hope because there's talk of putting the H.R. 6 language into the budget reconciliation that's coming up. If that happens, I mean, of all the undocumented persons in the U.S., those who were brought as children without any control, right, are the ones that are always viewed most positively. And even though the DREAM Act has failed to pass for 20 years, I think we're changing. So I think we have to be optimistic.
Daniel, currently there are an estimated 650 immigrants enrolled in the program. So there are a number of applicants who are essentially left in limbo now that they cannot get approval to when they submit an application. So what happens to those who were able to submit an application before the ruling but are now caught in this gray area?
Well, basically, they're just out the money for an application, both the nearly $500 it costs to pay for the application, as well as any attorney fees that they might have incurred in trying to file that application. It's important to remember that DACA was very fundamental for the families that were filing it. And so we were always advising that people file DACA when they have the opportunity. And now that promise has been taken away for Dreamers. It's possible that the appeal could be successful. It's possible Congress does something that allows the Biden administration to begin to approve those applications. But as the ruling is now, it's impossible for the Biden administration to approve those people who are currently held in limbo.
You know, the judge said that the current Dreamers are not that are protected. They're not impacted yet, but that's so open-ended. What are you hearing from current Dreamers and individuals that are protected under DACA about being in this kind of period of uncertainty?
Well, it's definitely a huge roller coaster and an impossibly cruel one at that, right? And that's basically the situation is Dreamers have been forced for years to be in a wait and see mode about whether or not we're going to allow them to remain in their home. Because again, these are people who were brought to the country at a young age and grew up in the United States, have learned here, have worked here. And we continue to put them on this roller coaster. And this ruling is just another example of that. Hopefully an appeal is successful, or hopefully Congress fixes the problem through the budget reconciliation process or through enacting something like the DREAM Act. But until then, they're in a really cruel wait and see period.
What are you suggesting to people who need to renew?
Well, right now, they should still go forward with the renewals. The opinion doesn't say that renewals will not be approved. The other piece is that even for those people who have yet to apply, it's unclear whether or not there'll be a stay of the ruling at this point. It's also unclear whether or not there'll be a reversal, whether the Biden administration will change its policy in such a way that the judge will no longer have a problem with it. And so for those folks as well, there's always some hope that very soon something will change that will make it possible to approve new applications again. And so basically the situation is that we're left with a lot of uncertainty, and we have to do our best to throw something at the wall and see what sticks. And unfortunately, that's sort of the story of the way that we treat immigrants in the United States, right? And so the situation is certainly worse, but it's one where we're going to continue to keep fighting. We're going to continue to keep trying to put persons in a position that if something good happens, they're ready to get their approvals, they're ready to get their renewals, right?
Maria, as a professor, have you worked with DACA recipients?
Oh, yes, we've had DACA in law school enrolled and now out and graduated and passed the bar and practicing law.
Have any of them reached out to you since the decision was made? And what are they telling you, if so?
None of my students have reached out, mostly because now they're graduates and busy, right? But the truth is that what we do know for them is that the opinion was clear that DHS may continue to accept new DACA applications. It's just not granting them. So folks, you know, if they have siblings who need to do this, they should do it still, because the applications can still be accepted. The renewals will continue because renewing is not granting a new application.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say, the last sentence of the opinion talks about, to be clear, neither this order nor the accompanying injunction requires the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Justice to take any immigration, deportation, or criminal action against any DACA recipient, applicant, or any individual that it would otherwise not take. So I see that as Judge Hannon saying, you know, I feel this is the law, the country and the law. But at least, as I said, I'm the Pollyanna in immigration law here, but I really hope that there can be a path, and the renewals are continue indefinitely, is what the opinion says.
Judge Hannon said that President Obama, who exceeded his executive authority back in 2012 when he created the program. What exactly did he mean by that?
What he means is that because we have, you know, our separation of powers with Congress and the executive and then the judiciary. And so the laws regarding immigration are all created by Congress and Immigration and Naturalization Act. And so what President Obama's order was to exercise what is called discretion. But what Hannon was pointing out as the discretion was to so many people that it ended up being the kind of program that really should have been through Congress or through rulemaking, not through an executive action of the president. So it's based on the Administrative Procedure Act. So it's basically the law about making laws that Judge Hannon used to rule the law about making laws of executive branches.
This was a federal judge in Texas that issued this ruling, but Texas was joined by other states, correct, in this effort?
State of Texas sued the government to try and stop DACA, exactly, once the Supreme Court was allowing DACA to continue by saying that Trump's decision to stop DACA was not arbitrary and capricious, all based on, again, these sort of archaic.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with two legal experts about the recent decision of a federal judge to end DACA. Daniel, Raices helps hundreds of undocumented youth apply to DACA. How is Raices helping recipients continue their journey towards citizenship, and how has the mission been changed given this ruling?
Well, first of all, the opinion allows for renewal. So we're going to continue to work with our current DACA recipients on the renewals. We're going to continue to advise them about what steps that they can take. If there's any daylight in this opinion that allows for us to seek similar remedies that we sought prior, we're going to fight for those. The other thing that Raices is working on is political advocacy. We had a caravan starting in San Antonio, Texas, going up to DC, advocating for Congress to use the budget reconciliation process in order to create a pathway to citizenship for immigrants, especially Dreamers. And so we're continuing to do that advocacy work as well.
I think it's important for people to understand, how long does this process traditionally take?
Are you talking about the DACA process?
Yes.
I mean, that depends on where you start the process, right? When you think about DACA, it's not an easy program to qualify for. Someone has to be brought to the United States at a young age. They have to grow up here. They have to either be enrolled in school, or they have to graduate from high school or be in the military. If you think of it like that, this program takes something like 16 years to be able to participate in. But on top of that, you have to go through the process of the federal government actually processing the form. And that depends, it varies. During the pandemic, there was a huge backlog of those applications. And so where you could have seen sort of approvals in months, you're now seeing much longer wait periods. And that's one of the problems with the actual timing of this ruling, because it happened at a time where there was this huge backlog.
The past year has been unlike any other. How has the pandemic bogged down or complicated the process for applying, or even for applications for new applicants, or also for renewals?
Well, I think it affects both. And it's just a reality that during the pandemic, the federal government was slowed in its efforts, as was others. You also had a problem where the administrative skill of the last administration was not very strong, and they weren't interested in focusing on DACA, even though they were ordered by the courts to do so. And so what we saw was a situation where USCIS was slowing down in sort of the process of renewing. And it's not one of those things where it's necessarily, I could say, you know, they were slowed by 6 months or they missed X deadline. The reality is it just gummed up the works. And then this ruling came at a time when that was happening. Hmm.
I guess, Maria, with that said, when it comes to backlog in renewals due to the pandemic, how does this ruling and the timing of this ruling further complicate catching up?
Well, because they can continue accepting applications, Homeland Security should be able to catch up, because they will just accept them. They don't have to grant them yet, because that's what they're enjoying for, and they can continue processing renewals. So I think almost they got a little breather in a way, unfortunately. But I think the process can continue, just no new granting. And that'll give them time to, as I said, catch up.
Daniel, when working with individuals closely, I mean, these individuals have been able to go to school and work without fear of deportation. The New York Times reports there were some 200,000 frontline workers who performed essential jobs during the pandemic: healthcare, agriculture, food processing, and education. Are you hearing any anecdotes about a concern of losing their jobs or having to quit their jobs because of this?
I've been hearing that since Congress failed to pass the DREAM Act, right? The DACA program was always supposed to be something that was a temporary deferral, and there was always concern involved with DACA that because it falls short of actually granting citizenship, that it creates essentially a second class for those who are Dreamers, who deserve citizenship in the country, right? And so definitely with the latest bad news, we're going to hear stories of Dreamers who are concerned that they're going to be losing their jobs in the long term. Judge Haynen, in the opinion, tries to sort of say, well, I'm not actually affecting people who are currently in the program, but eventually this will have that effect. He's saying that the program is unlawful. And although he's considering those reliance interests, I'd be hard pressed to find someone who currently has DACA that wouldn't be concerned upon hearing this news.
Are you optimistic that the Biden administration and Congress will come to a resolution?
I have some optimism because Dreamers are a group that has bipartisan support. I mean, the original DREAM Act was supported, or a co-sponsor, I believe, was Lindsey Graham, right? And so it seems to me that when you have the impetus coming from this opinion, and then you have the opportunity to fix the problem through the budget reconciliation process, there should at least be some hope that it can be done, right? And so that's kind of where my hope is. I don't know if I'd say optimistic, but I'm always hopeful.
What other concerns are you hearing from individuals currently protected under DACA?
There's concerns, especially for people who are students, who aren't sure how they can actually go about doing internships, who are in jobs and they're not sure whether or not they're going to be able to leave. There's sort of a huge mobility problem when you run into immigration issues and eliminating immigration relief. So that's another big concern. But in general, I think the big concern is that most people, the United States is their home, most Dreamers. And so the concern that they're not going to be able to just even operate to be able to work in the United States, it is terrifying.
Maria, expanding upon the worker angle, there's a worker shortage that we're already seeing in the United States, especially a shortage of nurses. So how does this decision impact that overarching challenge?
Well, certainly for those new applicants for DACA, that avenue right now is foreclosed. So it's really putting a stop to new help in the needed profession. So that's why if you look online, there's about 500 presidents of U.S. universities who have signed on, and there's a whole higher education and immigration policy, lot of work being done because the country does need the talents of these DACA applicants. And it's a short-sighted remedy to say, well, the law is illegal. Okay, well, now let's get going to fix it, right?
When it comes to the legal road ahead, what are the next steps that you're going to be really focusing on, Maria?
Well, I think since there's potential for following the Administrative Procedures Act, Judge Haynen's opinion kind of sets how to go about it. I mean, it ultimately could come that before you take away DACA, you would have to give individualized hearings to all those 800,000 plus who have the DACA. That would be a lot of work. And that's where you say, okay, so then we have to do something else. And that's the impetus, right, to legislation or at the very least rulemaking.
Daniel, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, unless Congress steps in with a remedy, DACA would have to be decided by the Supreme Court. Given the makeup of the Supreme Court, is that concerning to you?
It's definitely concerning. There's some hope with the DACA decision that came out last year about that the administration, not the administration, but that the court recognizes that these reliance interests are so important that the way to approach the question is a little different than the way that Judge Haynen approached it. Judge Haynen approached it purely from a sort of separation of power stance. And I think the APA in some ways instructs them to do that. But I think that this Supreme Court is willing to consider those reliance interests, willing to say that, willing to defer some level of prosecutorial discretion to the administration in order to best effectuate those policies. Because ultimately what's interesting about this opinion, right, is this opinion resounds in sort of separation of powers, but this judge injects himself into the process of creating these administrative rules that Congress ultimately gave to the president, right? And so hopefully the Supreme Court sees that and they recognize that the administration should have some weight in making those policy decisions and issues a favorable decision for Dreamers.
This process can take a long time into the foreseeable future. What are you going to be focusing on in the months ahead, Daniel?
Well, I think it's a really good question. I I think I want to make 2 points on that. First of all, it's always possible that the Biden administration appeals to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, sort of in between the district court and the Supreme Court, and they can ask for a stay. They can say, hey, this ruling is really harmful for a certain group of people. Will you please hold on the judge's ruling from going into effect until you actually have an opportunity to review it? Sometimes the circuit courts are willing to grant those orders. And with the right panel at the Fifth Circuit, you can make that happen. So I think the first thing is we need to be watching for that, because that's probably the first step that could protect streamers from this order. Now, the other piece is that we at Raices are always going to continue advocating for dreamers, going to continue to process and ask for renewals, going to continue to do the policy work to try to fix the problem, which is our very old and in need of updating immigration laws. And so I think watching that political fight is also going to be the next big step.
Yeah, I guess it's important to get a little bit of a history lesson. When was Raices created?
That's a really good question. And it was created many decades ago. In fact, far enough ago that I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it started as a very small organization. I think I remember three people, and it's just grown into a large organization, one of the largest legal service providers for immigrants. I wish I could give you the exact date, but it, decades ago.
Right. And when you're talking about, you know, the debate surrounding immigration, I mean, this goes back, or immigration reform, at least. I mean, that goes back decades.
Oh, absolutely. And Raices right now, we're on the front of trying to change the narrative about immigration in the United States. It's our big advocacy that we recognize the humanity of immigrants. And that doesn't just include dreamers. That includes everyone in this country who recognizes the United States as their home. Dreamers are an especially sympathetic group because this is the only home that they've ever known. And so we're going to continue to fight for them and continue to do everything we can.
Maria, any final thoughts about this ruling and what you're going to be focusing on and how maybe potentially this will shape law in the future, set a precedent?
Sure. And I agree with Daniel's comments here. I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that since 1982, children who come to the United States without papers, brought by their parents or whoever, have the ability to be educated for free under U.S. Supreme Court law. It's a case called Plyler versus Doe. So that strength of that opinion that we have since 1982 should make the dreamers feel that there has been times when the court found them to deserve certain things. And so they deserve this chance now to have this immigration system address their needs. The educational system responded, right? We have undocumented students attending K-12. Now it's up to higher education and the work. The ability to work to make them full persons. Believe it or not, the state of Texas back in that litigation in 1982 argued that undocumented people were not persons, and the Supreme Court said no. So, you know, we've heard some of this before, and we're going to keep at it.
Maria Pabon is a professor at Loyola University New Orleans College of Law, and Daniel Hatoum is an attorney with Raices. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Of course.
Still ahead, are you itching to learn a new skill? Maybe get a little creative. The Sac Theater Company is offering classes for adults to learn acting and tap dancing. You can join the conversation too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. If you didn't spend time over the pandemic learning a new skill, there's never really a bad time to start. It's always great to gain a new skill. Well, we have a creative option for you. The Sacramento Theater Company is offering classes for adults and summer sessions for kids to learn acting, dancing, and even more. So before I get into the rest of the details, I want to welcome Miranda Lawson. She is the Young Professionals Conservatory and Adult Education Program Manager at the Sacramento Theater Company. Miranda, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Miranda, starting off, when do these classes kick off?
Well, our very first class happens to be our TAP class, and it starts July 31st, Saturday morning. And then August 1st, we have our first acting class for adults. So they're starting right away.
What kind of response have you been getting?
Well, a crazy response. Our acting class actually sold out and was waitlisted. And it was so popular that we actually added, as of yesterday, a Tuesday class from 5:30 to 7:30, which is now on our website. And you can register for that one now because the response has been overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah, given the last 15, 16 months where we've been staying at home and our lives have been abruptly changed, what does that tell you that you're getting such a strong demand to be a part of these adult classes for adults or acting classes for adults?
Well, so many people, I think, had time to reflect on finding their own interests. I know that I did. And I think that some people are excited now to maybe take a risk where they weren't really ready to take a risk before. And now that it's open and it's available, it's something we at STC have been thinking about. And I finally was like, let's just do it. Let's see what happens. And we actually just confirmed winter session acting classes with Natasha House that start January 9th. And we now have a spring adult acting class that starts March 6th with Janice Stevens. So we've got a lot of opportunities for that.
Yeah, for the adults that are going to be starting class in just a couple weeks, what can they expect to learn?
Well, the age range for everybody is so vast. We have as young as 22 or 23, and we have people in their 70s. It's amazing, the turnout of people that are coming. It's sort of an introduction. So if you're brand new, you will get a taste of the intro to theater, stage right, stage left, upstage, downstage. But you also will be able to dive into the meat of choosing pieces, building a character, how to memorize, and you know, be a little bit more toward the intermediate stage by the time it's all done.
Yeah, actually, after I graduated from college, I took acting classes for about a year and was not good at all. That led me to a career in journalism, but it really did help me build skills that I applied outside of the studio. I would imagine, especially learning that there's such a wide age range, there are skills that you can apply to other parts of your life by taking these classes.
Absolutely. If you are a person who has to do public speaking or give meetings for your board members or, you know, your own like interpersonal TED Talks, taking acting classes is great just to build skills on projection, articulation, and being more comfortable in front of a crowd and confident. We have some students in our conservatory that went through our whole conservatory and are now going to be lawyers. It's not that everybody's going to Broadway, but the skills that you learn when you're here can help you in so many facets of so many different careers.
Yeah, and I feel like you also use a different part of your brain, and it's good to kind of get vulnerable with that.
Absolutely. Actors' emotions are always right at the surface, right on tap for us to access. And the memorization and the stamina that you need for it, it definitely is a whole athlete's body-mind perspective, for sure.
Who is going to be teaching the classes?
Brooklyn Solomon is teaching our first acting class, both the Sunday and the Tuesday that begin August 1st and 3rd. Our adult tap dance class that is on starting July 31st is being taught by Ryan Blanning. The winter quarter adult acting class is being taught by Natasha House, and the spring adult acting class is being taught by Janice Stevens.
And where are they taking place?
They are taking place on our campus here at the Sacramento Theater Company. And then they'll culminate with a showcase at the end, so you can invite, you know, maybe people that are close to you and say, hey, this is what I did. Look at what we did together.
It must feel so good welcoming people in person. How has the past, you know, year and a half been?
It's amazing that it's starting to at least feel a little more normal. different mental perspective, different plans in place for how operations go in the future, but definitely getting back to some sort of sense of normalcy. We were able to do our cabaret series throughout the past few months and do it virtually. So, you know, some of us were still fortunate enough to at least get to use our craft just a little bit, even though the room was empty. Our hearts were still full. So,
did you have video or Zoom sessions during the pandemic when you weren't able to meet in person?
Yes, our entire conservatory programs, the Young Professional Conservatory and our pre-professional ensemble company, did our entire 10-month season virtually. Wow. We did a few plays and musicals virtually, Radium Girls, Adam's Family, quarantine concert, the show Must Go Online. We had different cabarets for our students, tons and tons of masterclasses. We were able to bring in masterclass artists that could teach over Zoom that in any other circumstances might be really expensive to fly in and house. And so a lot of our students got to, you know, take masterclasses from people that are in Mean Girls on Broadway and people that were in Hamilton, the national tour, and in Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. And so it was all these amazing opportunities that honestly, without us being virtual, may not have happened. So it was a great way to expand their horizons even while we were all inside.
I guess given that, talking about the affordability of it, are any of those opportunities and those pivots during the pandemic, or are you going to be incorporating them, and are they here to stay?
I absolutely love the idea of some of our masterclasses being given over Zoom. I think it's a fantastic way for, again, those who might be a little pricier, those who may not have the schedule to leave their city, to be able to teach and instruct and give these kids once in a lifetime opportunities. A lot of our auditioning is probably still going to be video submissions to, you know, see new talent around the area. And there's definitely a new sense of excitement, camaraderie, inclusion that we as a company at Sacramento Theater Company are actively working on and excited to open the season with. We have Gloria is our opening show in October. We're bringing back A Christmas Carol. We've got Clue the Musical in the spring. We've got a concert series, a cabaret series. It's all super, super exciting.
Well, let's move on to the kids' camp. I believe you're there right now, right?
I am. I am here right now in the thick of it.
How does it feel? What's the scene like?
The scene is a lot of kids singing, a lot of happy dancing children, a lot of children learning classroom etiquette for the first time, which is super fun.
Classroom etiquette.
If some of our younger students spent maybe their first year of school at home, and being in a classroom setting is a new thing for them. So not only are our teaching artists and our counselors imparting artistic knowledge, we're also giving them just sort of life classroom skills. Here's how you raise your hand. Here's how you ask to go to the restroom. It's been an insanely positive turnout. We've sold out so many weeks of camp. Next week is also sold out, but we still have some space, definitely in our August camps. They're going fast though. So if you do have a child 6 years old all the way up to eighth grade, it's a great opportunity to get them singing, dancing, acting, in the arts, and maybe even out of the house for a week.
Yeah. How many sessions are there this summer?
There are 11. We are currently in session 6. And we go all the way through till, I think, like the second to the last week of August. So the schools that, you know, go back in a little bit later in different counties have the opportunity to still participate in our summer camp.
How long are each session?
Each session is a week. It's 5 days, Monday through Friday. We go from 8:30 to 5:30, technically 9 to 5, but we have a showcase opening night on our Friday of all of the things that students have learned throughout the week. Each camp has a theme, and so the music and the choreography, the arts and crafts all go with that theme. And so if you have a student who wants to take multiple sessions, as we often do, they're going to learn something new every time. It's new music, new acting, sometimes it's new instructors, new counselors. It's something you can do over and over and over again throughout the summer, and we have a lot of kids who come back multiple weeks throughout the summer.
Yeah, that is a full day, 9 to 5 for 5 days. That's like a work week. What do kids learn during the summer sessions? It just sounds like a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. Well, number one, they're making friends and they're learning just to love the arts. They learn some scenes in their acting class. They learn two songs, which if you can imagine learning two songs in 5 days that you have to then sing in front of people, that's so fast. Yeah. That they're learning. They learn two dances that go with those songs. They are making in arts and crafts props and costumes that match the theming of what they're doing. And it all culminates in a little hybrid show at the end of the week. So they are working very hard. We have lots of snacks and lunch and breaks so that everybody's not too tired, but it's great fun and they keep coming back for more.
Coming off of a year of distance learning, do these summer sessions for kids feel different to you?
Yes, they do. It feels warm. It feels exciting. It feels energized. There is a like vibrating sort of energy in just people being together. And it's something that while camp has always been fun, it's a new aspect of camp that's happening. And I don't know that we can recreate it again.
Miranda Lawson is with the Sacramento Theater Company. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Stephen Starbuck. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's Chief Content Officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.